Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come, join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs.
There's no graveyard way back deep in them woods. The thing you're looking for is in there.
There we are. Our second feature for this evening at the Haunted Drive-In, 1985's Pumpkinhead. A worthy choice, wouldn't you say, Victor?
Absolutely, Projectionist. Pumpkinhead has long been one of my favorite films. Not only is Lance Henriksen's performance amazing, as it usually is, but considering where I was raised, there are elements of the story that are similar to some tales that my grandparents and great-grandparents would tell me. In particular, how, to his dying day, my grandfather swore that he was actually helped by a witch in his youth. Perhaps that is a story best saved for when we actually tackle Pumpkinhead on the podcast.
A witch, you say? Why, I do not believe you have shared that particular yarn with me before, Sage. How do you feel about my Lance Henriksen double feature this evening?
No fooling, you picked two very solid films for Henriksen. Although, I have to say, you should have started chronologically in this case. Begin with Pumpkinhead, and then follow it with 1987's Near Dark, instead of the other way around.
Perhaps, dear boy, perhaps. Our patrons most assuredly seem to react well to Near Dark. Very boisterous in their approval in certain scenes, yes?
Well, when you have a cast like Near Dark's Tim Thomerson, Jeanette Goldstein, Ginny Wright, Troy Evans, Adrian Pasdar, and of course, the late and great Bill Paxton, there are a lot of memorable scenes, to say the least. Although, the same could be said about what we're going to be talking about on the podcast, the Tales from the Crypt episode entitled Cutting Cards.
That reminds me, Sage, I lent Preston Griffith quite a few of my EC Comics funny books. He said he wanted to digitize them for the Vault Library.
Sorry, Projectionist. I completely forgot to mention earlier. Preston finished with them and was going to have Rockford J return them immediately. Turns out, there was something of a security issue, though. I asked Rockford to check into it.
A security issue, you say? Perhaps we should ask intern Rockford.
Hey, Rockford isn't an intern anymore, remember? You mentioned it to the listeners on the last show, after all.
Technicalities. Always technicalities. As I meant to say, we should perhaps ask Rockford J to report to the projection booth after we finish our radio broadcast.
I'm almost afraid to ask, but why?
Follow me to my archives, Victor. These are where my collection of the Vault of Horror and the Haunt of Fear fun books should be stored. Look, nothing. Picked clean, yes.
Yeah, I can see there's nothing there to be sure. It sounds like there are lots of cases of missing things of late, my friend.
What of the security footage? Surely it is picking up something.
I'm afraid not, Projectionist. Every single time there's a theft, the security video is conveniently erased. I have a bad feeling that this has to do with Bobby Joe and the rest of his plague rat kin.
How is it then that intern Rockford J, as well as the security here at the vault, have been unable to find any sign of them?
I don't know, Projectionist. The vault is far deeper than the previous one, and has many tunnels, thanks to Bobby Joe and his kin. Maybe they're constantly moving around.
Highly doubtful, Victor. None of my wards have been triggered, and you will admit that the plague rats, while able to handle simple tasks and chores, were not the brightest.
Well, Bobby Joe seemed crafty enough. I just have this feeling that we've not seen the last of them. And if they do return, it will not be a good thing for any of us here in the vault.
And people have the audacity to call me paranoid, Sage.
Call me cautious, then. Something about a bipedal plague rat with poison quills, like Bobby Joe, that obviously had a beef with me, and just up and disappears without anyone noticing. Yeah, it kind of makes me uneasy.
Enough of your prattle. Look over there on the control panel. The recording light is on. Hello there, dear listeners, and welcome to a new episode of the Saturday Frights radio broadcast. Victor and I were just discussing some matters of security.
Friends, thank you for joining us as always. On this episode of the show, we're going to be discussing an episode of Tales from the Crypt entitled Cutting Cards, which originally aired a little over 30 years ago on HBO, on the night of April 21st of 1990.
The story of two gamblers who despise each other so greatly they are willing to cut to the chase and run the other out of town. Or, better yet, see the other man dead. No finer way to settle grievances, yes? Tell me, Sage, have you ever read the original story that this episodic television offering is based on?
I can't say that I've had the pleasure, Projectionist. Although, I do have a few reprints of some of the EC comic titles in my personal collection. I can tell you, they haven't lost any of their power to entertain, as well as shock in some cases.
Perhaps you would be interested to know, as would our dear listeners, that Cutting Cards was originally published in the October 1952 issue of EC Comics' Tales from the Crypt Funny Book, a delightfully devious story written by Al Feldstein and penciled as well as inked by Fred Peters, with coloring by Mary Severn. At least, it is presumed she did the coloring for this particular story.
I have to admit that I am not as familiar with Fred Peters' work, my friend. I did read he was a freelance artist, who not only got his start at the Walt Disney Studios, working on Pluto animated cartoons, but also did some of the Western and crime comic books at EC. Although, Al Feldstein, I most certainly do know, as he was a triple threat in the comics world. Not only an artist, but a writer and editor. As I understand it, it was he and William Gaines that co-created Tales from the Crypt, right?
Quite correct, Victor. The late and great William Max Gaines inherited stewardship of EC Comics when his father, Maxwell Gaines, died tragically in a boating accident. Were you aware, though, that Maxwell Gaines was responsible for the process, an idea that would lead to the creation of what you call comic books?
I did, man. In fact, back in 1933, while Max was working at Eastern Color Printing, which handled the printing of Sunday morning comic strips for newspapers, he got the bright idea of collecting those strips together in a kind of pamphlet and set out to see if they could use them as a sort of advertisement for Procter & Gamble products. Kids could purchase these reprints for a whole nickel as long as they had a coupon or even labels from a P&G product. At least that was the plan. The company decided to pass on the idea of selling it. But after Gaines got permission from his boss, Harry L. Wildenberg, he produced Funnies on Parade, which was 8 pages of such comic strips as Mutton Jeff, Joe Palooka, Regular Fellers, to name a few. It had a print run of 250,000 copies and could be obtained from sending in coupons found on Procter & Gamble products. It went over extremely well for Eastern Color and Max, so they began working with other companies, creating more small collections for them with the same concept. Although, after the initial Funnies on Parade did so well, Max Gaines was surprised to find he was sacked by Eastman Color. Although he was able to land a gig at McClure Syndicate, which owned a majority of the characters printed in Funnies on Parade. There, they had 2 color presses at their disposal. Gaines had them hooked up so they could produce 4 color printings and decided comic books were the future. Along with Dell Publishing, Gaines created Popular Comics, which just so happens to be the comic book debut of the likes of Dick Tracy, Little Orphan Annie, and Terry and the Pirates, among others. It was while working at McClure that Max Gaines befriended Harry Donenfeld, who was the owner of National Allied Publications, what would become DC Comics. Gaines apparently was printing a comic book for NAP entitled Detective Comics. It was in 1937, after Max had met with 2 young men named Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who had an idea for a comic book character called Superman. He took this idea to Donenfeld, who, from all accounts, had little faith in the character, but featured Superman in Action Comics number 1 in June of 1938.
I believe that character proved quite popular.
Yeah, to say the least. Max Gaines, as well as Harry Donenfeld, partnered up to publish comic books under the title All American Publications. While there were a few reprints of newspaper strips like Mutton Jeff, the comic also provided brand new stories. As I understand it, All American Publications produced the likes of All American Comics, as well as Flash Comics. Yes, that Flash. Characters that were created for All American Comics include the Golden Age Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, Dr. Midnight, and Sargon the Sorcerer. But thanks to the great relation with National and Donenfeld, their characters of Dr. Fate, the Spectre, and even Starman would appear in the pages of All-Star Comics.
But all good things come to an end, dear listeners.
Yeah, apparently Donenfeld handed over half of his controlling interest to Jack Liebowitz. It sounds like Gaines and Liebowitz didn't see eye to eye. And in 1945, Max asked to be bought out by the 2 men for a sum of $500,000. Which would be the equivalent of $7 million these days. Max Gaines wasn't finished with the comic book industry, though, because 2 weeks after that deal was struck, he formed EC Comics, which stood for Educational Comics, and he began producing such comic books as Animal Fables, which was a funny animal book, as well as picture stories from the Bible, picture stories from American history, and so on. It probably won't surprise you to learn, listeners, that they didn't sell very well. Profits for EC Comics failed to materialize, and by 1947, it has been said that the company was $100,000 below the line. One of those reasons might be with the name of the comic publisher themselves. I mean, Educational Comics doesn't exactly make a kid want to rush out and pick up their books, right? Although, for what it is worth, in my research for this episode, I have found 2 different versions of who is responsible for changing EC Comics from Educational Comics to Entertaining Comics. One source says it was Max Gaines who made the decision, and the other states that it was his son. For my money, I personally believe it was Bill Gaines that made the decision.
1947, as I have already said, is the year that Maxwell Gaines died in a tragic boating accident. A retreat from concerns over the business, as well as to ease his wife's anxiety over the recent divorce of their son, William Gaines. Although Maxwell perished, along with his best friend, Sam Irwin, the front of their boat was hit by another vessel on Lake Placid. Sam's young son, Billy, was saved by the elder Gaines' quick thinking. It has been told he picked up Billy, who I assume was standing with his father and Maxwell Gaines at the front of the boat, and then threw him to the back of the boat at the last second.
Projectionist, you might be interested to know that in Digby Deal's excellent book, Tales from the Crypt, the official archives, that incident is discussed in a little more detail, as well as the fact, in all honesty, it does sound like Max Gaines was a pretty stern father, and at least in Bill Gaines' mind, was disappointed in his only son. In fact, apparently in Frank Jacobs' 1970 book, The Mad World of William M. Gaines, Bill was quoted as saying that his father shouted at him, quote, "You'll never amount to anything," end quote. This was done supposedly while whipping his son with a belt. I bring this up, listeners, to help better illustrate why Bill Gaines had no desire in the least to have anything to do with his father's business of publishing comic books. Bill instead, after enlisting in the Army Air Corps upon his discharge 4 years later, decided to enroll in NYU to get his education so that he might become a high school chemistry teacher. As I understand it, he was mere months away from earning his degree. Then his father died. I have read that it was his mother who convinced Bill Gaines to take his father's position at EC Comics. He thankfully had a bit of help with those who had worked with his father while he learned the ropes of becoming a comic book publisher, which, to the young man's surprise, he found he actually enjoyed comic books after giving them a chance. But the question, of course, was how to fix the sales of EC Comics.
The first thing was to attempt to jettison the funny book titles that obviously were not a success with the children of the day. An attempt to match the type of stories being published by the more popular funny book publishers at the time.
That is correct. His fortunes changed, or you might even say that fate stepped in when, in 1948, Bill was able to entice a young artist by the name of Al Feldstein, who was working at another comic book publisher at the time, to pop into EC Comics' office and show off his work. Al had a deft hand at what I would consider good girl art. It was Gaines' hope that he could start publishing a book that might be in line with the popular Archie comics. Feldstein started working on illustrating the comic that would be called Going Steady with Peggy, and then—
But it was never completed. As it turned out, there was a whole slew of comics on the stands and racks that were similar to the Archie funny book.
Exactly. Both Bill and Al saw that there was no point in throwing good money into publishing a comic book that wouldn't be able to stand out in the crowd. So Al told Gaines to just destroy the contract they had for Going Steady with Peggy. Instead, Al would stick with Bill and EC and try to figure out what would sell well enough to help everyone involved. First came some changes to the titles of the comics that were currently being published, to be more like what was trending with comic genres being published by other companies, like Western, crime, and romance comic books. By all accounts, it seems like Al Feldstein and Bill Gaines really became the best of friends. And thanks to Digby Deal's Tales from the Crypt, the official archives again, we know it was Al, who was given lifts home by Bill at the end of the day, who had an epiphany, saying, quote, "You know, Bill," he began, "we're really fools for following the crowd. Crime comics, westerns, romances. This is an industry where everybody follows and very few take the lead. But it's the guys who are innovators who really prevail. All the imitators fail eventually," end quote. I will, of course, as always, provide a link to where you can pick up Deal's book on this podcast article on the Pop Culture Retrorama site. If you are a Tales from the Crypt fan, you deserve to add it to your personal library. One of the things that both Gaines and Feldstein both appreciated was horror radio series. In particular, I've read that Al pointed out the likes of Alonzo Dean Cole's The Witch's Tale, a great old-time radio series that, back in my days at The Retroist, I shared on the Retro Radio Memories podcast more than a couple times.
Al Feldstein put forth the question why the two of them couldn't produce a funny book equivalent to The Witch's Tale, Lights Out, and Inner Sanctum radio programs.
In particular, Projectionist, they felt a comic book with a host, like those radio shows you just mentioned, was the key to success. And they weren't wrong. In addition, as I already mentioned, Feldstein proved himself to be a triple threat, as he was not only a fantastic artist, but he could also write, and, as he would soon prove, he was a fantastic editor. Bill and Al still wanted to test the waters, however, and with Crime Patrol No. 15, which hit the stands in December of 1949, thanks to a story entitled Return from the Grave that was penned and illustrated by Feldstein, the Crypt Keeper made his debut. In the next issue of Crime Patrol, Bill and Al injected more horror tales. And with the following issue, Crime Patrol was renamed the Crypt of Terror. Two more issues were published before it underwent a name change once again to Tales from the Crypt.
William Gaines and Al Feldstein acted as co-editors on the funny book from 1950 until its untimely and extremely unfortunate demise in 1955 due to the publication of Frederick Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent, which whipped up a frenzy of parental and government concern on the effects of these funny books on children, especially those relating to the horror genre. There were 27 issues of Tales from the Crypt published. Furthermore, the popularity of the funny book led to two additional horror books being created by Al Feldstein and Bill Gaines in 1950, The Vault of Horror and The Haunt of Fear, as well as introducing two additional horror hosts to the public. Golunatics, as they were mentioned in the EC comic books themselves, with The Vault Keeper and The Old Witch. I believe you, dear listeners, can guess which hosted which funny book, yes?
Listeners, the whole attack on horror comics was a pretty bad time for Bill Gaines, to say the least. Here he had found something that he enjoyed doing, making a good living while doing it. He even appeared in front of the Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency to defend the books that EC Comics were publishing, but to no avail. All of this resulted in the creation of the self-regulating Comics Code Authority, as well as the Comics Magazine Association of America, which was something that Bill felt was ridiculous and refused to take part in. At the very least, 1955 was not the end of EC Comics, however, as they were publishing a magazine at the time, started back in 1952, called Mad. Although the initial editor for the magazine was Harvey Kurtzman, the reins were handed over to Al Feldstein in 1956, a role he held until 1984. We should also point out that under his stewardship, the subscription numbers rose to over 2 million between 1973 and 1974. Not a bad legacy. Although, of course, we know that like any good property, Tales from the Crypt and the other EC horror comics and hosts have thankfully refused to stay dead. The trio of titles that EC Comics published would find itself being republished through the years, influencing future generations with its excellent tales of the macabre and murder. Tales from the Crypt would find itself being made into a fantastic 1972 anthology picture, starring the likes of Sir Ralph Richardson as the Crypt Keeper, Joan Collins, Ian Hendry, and Peter Cushing, to name just a few. Adapting stories featured in all three of EC Comics' horror titles. The popularity of that film led to a second feature, The Vault of Horror, being produced the following year, with the likes of Tom Baker, Terry Thomas, Daniel Massey, and others starring in its five tales of terror. Although sadly, the second film wasn't as popular, at least not popular enough for it to lead to a third film being put together. Naturally, an adaptation of The Haunt of Fear. But then, in the early 1980s, none other than director, producer, and screenwriter Walter Hill would be reminded of his childhood love of Tales from the Crypt, thanks to the Russ Cochran hardcover reprints in 1979. I think it's safe to say that Hill generally knows what works with films, having wrote and directed the likes of The Warriors, 48 Hours, and the cult classic Streets of Fire, to name a few. He saw how easily the stories written by both Bill Gaines, Al Feldstein, and others could be adapted into feature films. So, he took the collection to his friend and fellow producer as well as writer, David Giler, who, you listeners might recall, we talked about a couple episodes back when we tackled Alien. Giler agreed that these stories could work. In addition, at that time, which was 1983, they were busy with Streets of Fire, which was produced by Joel Silver. While visiting them, he happened to see Hill's collection of those reprints of Tales from the Crypt, and after checking them out, felt they should attempt to get a new anthology picture in the works. Placing a quick call with his lawyers, they paid Bill Gaines for the rights to make a new Tales from the Crypt film. In fact, Walter Hill is quoted in Digby Deal's book about how easy it was to gain the rights, saying, quote, "It all went very smoothly, because I think he associated us with high-class movie making. Before this, he'd always been dealing with people who just wanted to make horror movies," end quote.
"He's correct, dear listeners. The 1972 Tales from the Crypt and 1973 Vault of Horror pictures are very good and enjoyable, but they are missing some of that magic of the EC Comics funny books themselves."
Fun, projectionist. The wicked fun that the EC Comics hosts provided. A tongue-in-cheek reminder that it was okay to enjoy the stories of animated corpses, monsters, and supernatural revenge. Generally delivering a comeuppance to some shady characters that truly deserve their fate.
Well said, Victor.
Thank you, my friend. So, plans were set in motion for this new Tales from the Crypt film. Although, as most of you are aware, rarely do films just get the green light and go into production. There are many hurdles for them to overcome. The years started to pass. In the meantime, however, thanks to Joel Silver, Richard Donner, at that point best known for the likes of 1976's The Omen and 78's Superman, wanted to join the film. This appears to be in around 1986, and still nothing solid materialized beyond these four wanting to see a Tales from the Crypt film put into production, something that would honor its source material up on the big screen. 2 more years would pass, listeners, and thanks to Joel Silver again, this time having a cameo in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, they managed to bring Robert Zemeckis into the group. Although, by now, the thought of a film had started to turn to that of a television series.
Yes, after all, look at how many stories there were that could be adapted into an episodic television show.
Exactly. Zemeckis, however, knew that if it landed on any of the 3 major networks, it couldn't be done. But cable television, however, where there were no such restrictions on gore, nudity, and violence, that could work. With David Giler, Walter Hill, Robert Zemeckis, Richard Donner, and of course Joel Silver as partners, the latter was pretty positive that HBO would be more than willing to pay for a Tales from the Crypt TV show. Although, remember, they had paid Bill Gaines for the rights to make a feature film, so they apparently had to have some meetings with him and secure the licensing for a television series now. Bill was no fool, and he obviously could see that it made much more sense, even from a production cost viewpoint, to forget about a movie at the present and go with a cable TV adaptation. There was only one thing that Gaines insisted on when giving his approval. The stories for these Tales from the Crypt episodes would only come from the work published by EC Comics, a stipulation that everyone involved within the project was quite happy to agree to. And for 7 seasons, with 93 episodes, the Tales from the Crypt series adapted not just from the Tales from the Crypt comic book, but shock suspense stories, Crypt of Terror, Haunt of Fear, Vault of Horror, and crime suspense stories. With just 1 animated episode, the last episode, in fact, being adapted from the Three Little Pigs fable, although definitely given a Tales from the Crypt twist. The Tales from the Crypt series proved extremely popular from the very start, and to the delight of Hill, Silver, Giler, Zemeckis, and Donner, legions of actors, directors, writers, and film score composers wanted to join in on the fun, including a digitally resurrected Humphrey Bogart for the episode entitled You Murderer. Listeners, I know that we've touched on some of this stuff on the past Saturday Frights episodes where we've tackled Tales from the Crypt episodes. Although, with this 3rd season, The Projectionist and I wanted to present more history and interesting information, instead of those drawn-out synopsis. EC Comics and Tales from the Crypt has such a rich history, as I believe we have amply demonstrated, and even then, we've barely scratched the surface. But I think it is more than time for us to start discussing Cutting Cards, the 3rd episode of Season 2 of Tales from the Crypt, directed by Walter Hill, who co-wrote the teleplay with Mae Woods. The two would also write the teleplay for the Tales from the Crypt episode entitled Deadline, and Woods would also pen the script for Maniac at Large, a 1992 episode. Just before we begin, though, we're going to take a quick break. In case you haven't seen Cutting Cards for yourself, pause the podcast. And if you take a peek around the internet, you're bound to find the episode. We'll be waiting for you. As always, The Projectionist has a little something for you to listen to during the break.
Indeed I do, Sage.
from the man who gave you 48 hours. Revolting, but so current. Need a little holiday feel? Shall I scare up the man who framed Roger Rabbit?
The killer is here!
You asked for it. You got it. Oh. Screaming for more? I have this little number from Superman's supermaster.
They sought to kill you.
Doc, no!
I wouldn't count on it, but you can count on my directors. Three Tales from the Crypt, June 10th on HBO. It's a night to dismember.
Warning, strong content. Parental discretion advised.
All right then. Just before we dive into cutting cards, I want to address something that I noticed on both the Internet Movie Database as well as on Wikipedia, which is that it credits the series creator for Tales from the Crypt as being one Stephen Dodd. This is the only listing for Dodd, and he's credited for all 93 episodes, with the Wikipedia entry claiming it was Gaines and Dodd that created the TV series, which is a little strange. I can find no mention of this in Digby Deal's book, unless I missed it, but I did check the index and there's nothing. I also checked every single credit at the end of this Tales from the Crypt episode, and there is no mention of a Stephen Dodd. So I'm wondering if perhaps this is a pseudonym for someone, for Gaines perhaps, but I don't see why, especially as it only appears to be an online credit. Anyway, I thought that was something of interest to pass along.
How very curious, Victor. Perhaps the dear listeners might be able to shed more light on the subject.
I hope so, man. Cutting Cards is easily in my top 10 episodes of Tales from the Crypt. It has the benefit of an extremely tight teleplay by Hill and Woods. And while there are like three or four minor characters, this is an episode that has only a few locations. Instead, focusing on the powerhouse performances of both Lance Henriksen as Reno Krevis and Kevin Tighe as Sam Forney. Now, I had caught this episode of Tales from the Crypt originally thanks to one of those HBO-free weekends. You know, a couple times a year, they would let everyone get a glimpse of what they were missing. And I would just keep a stack of blank VHS tapes handy. I lucked out as they were showing a marathon of Tales from the Crypt, so I was able to grab a few.
Do you remember by chance which episodes were aired, Sage?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were Only Sin Deep with Leah Thompson, Collection Completed with Three's Company's Audra Lindley, as well as M. Emmett Walsh, and I want to say The Switch with William Hickey and Kelly Preston. I watched them over and over again, my friend. Now, for what it might be worth, by the time that Cutting Cards aired, I was quite familiar with Lance Henriksen, thanks of course to his role as Bishop in Aliens, and of course in The Terminator, as well as Near Dark and Pumpkinhead. However, while I didn't know who he was at the time, I did catch him first in 1977's Close Encounters of the Third Kind and 1978's Damien, Omen 2. With his characters in Pumpkinhead and Aliens, and of course on the TV show Millennium, Henriksen has this great ability to just switch from a nice guy to someone you would never in a million years want to cross. Something about his eyes. There is a scene in particular in Pumpkinhead where he glares at a fellow actor. There is so much anguish and hatred in that look that I'm surprised the other actor didn't just drop dead on the spot. Now, I knew of Kevin Tighe thanks to watching the hit TV series Emergency with my grandparents back in the 70s. But I also knew him from roles in the likes of 1989's K-9 and Roadhouse. And he would go on to star in the Stephen King TV miniseries Rose Red. These two actors really deliver the goods with this episode, running the gamut of red-hot rage to fear
and pain. A whole lot of pain when the two begin to cut more than cards.
Indeed. As Cutting Cards begins, we are introduced to Reno Krevis, lately of Las Vegas, but it seems like he's had a run of bad luck, and he might even have possibly been chased out of town. He is a high-stakes gambler by trade, and appears to have returned to his hometown, judging by his first name. The way that Henriksen plays the character, who's decked out in Western attire, it's a little like the way that Amarillo Slim was known to dress, actually. But Reno has a shifty air about him. We can see how nervous he is in the way he looks around the parking lot of the casino he's just driven up to.
It might be smaller than what Reno Kravis was used to in Las Vegas, but there are those working the floor of the gambling hall that recognize him. Although the server gives him a bit of bad news along with his free drink.
Yeah, she tells him that Sam Forney is lording it over the game in the back room. And Reno and Sam plainly have some past history. And judging by the look of disgust on Crevice's face, it's not good. He gets a word of warning from the bartender about Forney's skill as well. And Reno's responses are prickly at the best. In the back room, Sam Forney is playing solitaire. Judging by his business suit attire and fancy gold ring, is doing well enough for himself. And he wastes little time before he starts trading verbal jabs with Reno, explaining the usual gathering of gamblers couldn't keep up with him, and he ran them off. After cleaning them out, of course. It's pretty obvious that each gambler sees themselves as being the superior player. And through their back and forth, we learn that Reno won $10,000 off Sam back in Vegas. But at some point, Forney won Crevice's Cadillac. Something that surely his wife would have noticed. But then, Sam reveals that Reno's wife left him.
Do you believe that Sam Forney is telling the truth? Or is he just winding up his fellow gambler?
I think it's both. We should point out that Sam seems a little surprised by the aggressive stance that Reno initially takes at his remarks.
How about I just leap over this table and wipe that smile off your face?
I got a tip for you, Reno. You take on everybody that laughs at you, you're gonna have a lifetime of work.
Nobody laughs at me.
Sure they do. They all laugh at you. They laugh at your wife, they laugh at your clothes, they laugh at this dumb redneck cowboy way you got of talking and thinking.
You're working me, Forney. You're working me.
Yeah, I'm working you. No doubt about it. I love watching you itch. Heard you went bust in Vegas.
You heard wrong.
Really? Well, a lot of people told me about it.
I think you can see what I mean about Sam's barbs. They cut both ways, though. And these two men really, really can't stand one another. Although obviously not included in that clip, Reno and Sam were probably friendly at one point, because the latter mentions that any time in the past that they've teamed up, one of them always gets burned. As Reno appears to only have $100 to his name, which isn't worth Forney's time apparently, he offers up a different kind of payout. The loser of the wager has to clear out of Reno and never return. The two agree to a quick game of dice, but both roll double sixes. Reno, losing his temper, suggests they raise the stakes a little. A game of Russian roulette.
And Sam Forney just so happens to have a 44 in the glove compartment of his automobile.
I really can't praise the acting of Henriksen and Ty enough. While this episode moves at a fast pace, the way the two play off each other, you just totally go along with the fact they despise each other so much that the situation escalated to the point of each wanting to see the other dead. Reno obviously doesn't trust Sam, snatching the gun from him and loading the single bullet himself before giving the chamber a solid spin. Forney goes first, pressing the barrel of the weapon against the temple of his head. He summons up his courage and pulls the trigger, relieved that nothing happens but a dry click. Reno takes his turn, getting angry at Sam for talking while he's trying to concentrate.
Of course, dear listeners, the dark humor of this episode is that all of it could be avoided if just one of these men would put aside their grievances and just leave town.
The anger and hate runs too deep, though, for Reno and Sam. Obviously, the gun only has six chambers. With each pull of the trigger, the chances increase that one of them is going to end up dead. Although, their morbid little game is momentarily interrupted when a loudmouth and his date pull into the parking lot where they're playing Russian roulette. Reno is quick to mouth off to the guy. But, curiously enough, when this new arrival starts to get worked up, Sam appears quickly beside Reno and points the gun at the loudmouth.
Did you notice that Sam Forney says, "You hurt my friend," without hesitation?
Oh, most definitely. He is by all accounts coming to Reno's rescue. Although, after the loudmouth drives off at top speed, Reno swivels on Sam. He isn't going to call the wager off. By this point, Forney has a 50-50 chance. Too rich for my blood, projectionist, but Sam pulls the trigger, and once again, he is spared. Which means that unless Reno accepts defeat, he's going to be committing suicide by pulling that trigger again. To Sam's dismay, though, Crevice jams the barrel of that gun against his temple, looking at the other man right in the eye, knowing these will be the last words he ever says.
I want him to say that he went out strong. God! A gun?
What happened?
You put a ringer in! You're playing the whole thing! That's why you wanted to go first. You thought I'd crawl?
You set the chamber. You gave it a spin. How was I to know it'd come up last? That ammo, 2 or 3 years old. Maybe it got wet.
Ah, you can't talk your way out of this.
The tension during this scene is thick enough you can cut it with a knife.
You mean a meat cleaver, don't you?
You're getting ahead of yourself. I'm sorry, but I do not believe that Sam somehow rigged the wager. But Reno's blood is boiling, and he gets Forney spitting mad after he continuously accuses him of cheating. It's Sam that suggests a new type of game, although just as serious and deadly. Chop poker.
Indeed! A simple game, a 5-card draw. The hands are played, and the loser loses a finger, courtesy of the opposing player and that meat cleaver.
With two doctors standing silently in the background, and a neutral card dealer, the game begins. And
you have to hand it to Reno Crevice for winning the first game, Victor.
Yeah. You and the Crypt Keeper should trade puns. Anyway, Reno picks up that meat cleaver and asks Sam which finger he wants to lose first. Forney removes that gold pinky ring from his hand, and Crevice slams the blade down on Sam's finger. As you might expect, Sam screams in pain. The special effects for this scene are pretty gruesome, although I personally don't believe it's over the top with its gore. But you can just feel it when a finger is chopped off. Sam has apparently done something to upset Lady Luck, because he also loses the next round. And Kevin Tai does a remarkable job of conveying the pain he's in. The doctors, of course, have bandaged his hand. Reno, however, is pretty satisfied with himself, remarking that he plans on pickling Sam's fingers. Something to show off to his friends.
Perhaps instead of gloating, Reno Crevice should be paying attention to the cards he has been dealt.
Most definitely, projectionist, because he loses the third round. Although Crevice attempts to avoid having a finger cut off by offering to give back one of Sam's fingers, commenting that the doctor standing by them could reattach it. Forney, though, would rather give Reno a taste of his own medicine, grinning maniacally as he shakily holds up the meat cleaver before chopping off one of Crevice's index fingers. As Reno screams in agony, the scene changes to that of a medical ward. We can see the game apparently continued through the night, as Reno and Sam are sitting on the floor, playing a game of checkers, moving the pieces with their noses, as they both are missing their hands, arms, legs, and feet. The two are still trying to best each other, with Sam getting the upper hand with Reno's last move, remarking for Crevice to pass the gum before the scene freezes and the two butt heads and glare into each other's eyes. And that, friends, is the synopsis for Tales from the Crypts, Cutting Cards. It really is a perfect example of what made the Tales from the Crypt comics so special. The stories really stuck with you, as did more than a few of the adaptations for HBO's Tales from the Crypt series, which obviously is why we've discussed a handful of them on the podcast. As always, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to the show, and we hope you're enjoying Season 3 so far. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy, my co-host. The Projectionist has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He manages to share interesting trivia on films on a daily basis, or sometimes just vintage movie posters and behind-the-scenes photographs of some of your favorite films. As always, I want to thank Rockford J for putting up with the abuse of the Projectionist on a nearly daily basis. I couldn't keep a lid on the vault without his hard work. Every day, he shares his love of the horror genre over on the Saturday Frights Facebook page. As for myself, you can still find me posting on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee, and of course, the Pop Culture Retrorama site too. Saturday Frights has an Instagram account, by the way. If you want to check it out, you can find it. It's simply Saturday_Frights. If you'd like to contact me with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at VicSagePopCulture@gmail.com. For all things pop culture and retro related, feel free to visit us at the Pop Culture Retrorama site. Generally, we try to have something of interest to share a couple of times a day. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist. Not just for originally hosting the podcast, but for allowing us for nearly 10 years to share our love of all things retro. If you like the show, consider subscribing and giving us a rating over on iTunes. We're also available on Google Podcast and Spotify and Stitcher. As we end the show, why not listen to a clip from the film we will be discussing on the next show?
Why are they doing this? They said when you got here the whole thing started. Who are you? What are you? Where did you come from? I think you're the cause of all this. I think you're evil! Evil!
I think they're going.
This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Saturday Frights podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by HBO, EC Comics, or any of the businesses and individuals that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only, and are not intended to infringe.
Ha 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 ha.